Thank you, John Michael, and to all of you for welcoming me into this amazing book club. I have to, you know, I'm new to Santa Barbara, so I didn't even know this existed until John Michael invited me. So I think it's a profound endeavor that you're on, especially the interfaith aspect of it. It's, I think, really courageous and noble. And so I want to just thank you for leading the way in that regard. As John Michael said, I'm originally from Minneapolis, Minnesota, which means, yes, I'm a Garrison Keillor fan, in case you're wondering. So I'm not going to go too much into my own sort of personal background right now, but feel free to ask any questions about what John Michael talked about in my biography, how I got here, why I decided to become a rabbi. I'm not going to go too much into that right at this minute, but I welcome any of those questions. So one of the things that sort of struck me about this idea of compassion, and, you know, I've followed Karen Armstrong's work for a long time. I mean, she's one of the foremost scholars in the history of world religions. And so I thought it was interesting when John Michael called me and said, you know, would you be up for reading a Karen Armstrong book? And I thought, oh my God, it's going to be 300 pages. and she's a very, you know, if you've read her other works, she's a very dense, scholarly writer. And so, but what I sort of love about this book is that she sort of trims it all away and gets down to the core of it. So I will be interested in hearing some of the other sort of learnings that you had in the other weeks. Because I wasn't able to be here. We just kind of came out of our high holiday season, so we had about a month of high holidays, and so now I'm back to normal and happy to be here. So I want to just start with sort of like the definition of compassion. And you guys may have done a little bit of this, but I think I can provide some different insights. In the late 12th century in Latin, really, this idea of compassion, some of you may know Latin better than I do, but from my understanding, it's compati. So it really means with pity or to feel pity. It was only later, really, or perhaps around the same time, that the Latin also was referring to patio, to suffer, to endure. And in the 12th century, we have this idea of the Passion of the Christ. So compassion could really mean to suffer with somebody, if you think about it from the Latin root. And in many ways, that's the idea, perhaps, of empathy. But one could argue that empathy and suffering are different, and we're not going to go there yet, but we could. And then compassion, you know, or the notion of passion, later developed in the 13th century to mean strong desire or emotion. So we have all of these. It could be pity, it could be suffering, and it could be a strong emotion or desire. We have all of these within the Latin root of compassion. We have all of these possibilities. And you might say, why am I talking about Latin and the Latin roots? Well, everything, when you study biblical Hebrew, it's all about the root. And what's so interesting about biblical Hebrew is that every root can have, you know, 5 to 10 possibilities. So how do we study it? How do we know what the true meaning of a word is? We find its extremes, and then we figure out and we build in. So that's kind of what I wanted to do with the Latin, to compare and contrast what you can glean from the Latin root of compassion compared to what I'm about to explain about the Hebrew root of compassion. So compassion and mercy are often interchanged and used interchangeably, and I'd be curious to know when we have our dialogue to you what's the difference between compassion and mercy. And before I move on to mercy, I should say that sort of what I want to do in the first 45 minutes is kind of look at it from more of an intellectual viewpoint of what is compassion from the Jewish perspective. But, you know, how do we implement it? How do we go forward? You know, how do we utilize it? I think that we should talk about that in the question and answer. So you'll have to excuse that this might be a little bit, you know, sort of academic in the beginning, but then we can get to the personalization of it. But I think it'll be enlightening nonetheless. So the idea of mercy really is, at least around the 12th century, was meant to signify the idea of God's forgiveness of human flaws, right? And so in the 10th century, in Old French, interestingly enough, it also could mean a reward or a gift. So we have this idea of compassion and mercy, and mercy is more in line with this idea that there's a superior power that has an ability to forgive an inferior power. And the powers might be God and human in this case, okay? It might even mean a king to a thief. You know, something like that where you're talking about a power dynamic where the person who has more power is able to have mercy on the person who has less power. It could be a relational dynamic. It doesn't have to be, you know, a national dynamic. But that's sort of what mercy is. In a little bit, which is different from compassion, which we talked about, which is really about to empathize, to feel pity, to suffer with somebody, that doesn't take a power dynamic or hierarchical relationship. So I thought that was interesting when you, because we use mercy and compassion all the time, sort of interchangeably, but according to its historical roots, there is sort of a difference between mercy and compassion. So what I want to sort of get at with, so what does this lead us to Judaism? The interesting thing is, I was giving a talk a few months ago at the Braille Institute, and somebody asked me sort of, you know, what is, how would you typify the God of Judaism? Right? So because I often hear in Christian circles that God is love. Does that ring true to some of you? Okay. I'm actually asking for, like, really seriously. Because it doesn't ring true for me in Judaism. So what is the God in Judaism? For me, God is a God of compassion. So God is actually, in Hebrew, it's known as Av HaRachamim, the abundant father of kindness. And I use father very loosely. I don't believe God has a gender, and the biblical language was very gendered, so I'm kind of constrained by that. But this notion that God is a God of compassion, right? So what is rachamim in Hebrew? So it comes from the Akkadian word meaning remu, okay? And it literally means womb. So our rechem is our womb. And, you know, so this idea of God of compassion, it's not about suffering, it's not about pity, it's about being God of a life-affirming relationship, a God of safety, a God of security. It's the rechem of the womb is the origins of all life. This is a beautiful imagery, you know, to think about what is God for us. So that's what sort of, you know, when I have conversations, interfaith dialogue like this, I'm often struck by the difference between a God of love and a God of compassion. And not the English version of compassion. That's really important. It's the Hebrew notion of compassion. So there's a few places I'm going to just mention where this notion of rechem or womb is used. And again, there is not one single definition in Hebrew of this root, which is rech, Resh, Chet, Mem. Okay, again, there's in Hebrew, it's the issue is manifold. Words are manifold. So for one example, in the book of Job, Job basically says, isn't the one who made me and the womb also make him? Did he not that made me and the womb make him? Weren't we fashioned in one womb? Okay, for Job, it's this question of, you know, How are we really any different, right? He gets to the point of, if you know the book of Job, such extreme anguish about life and punishment and feeling like he's been unjustly treated by God, that he asks the questions, aren't we of one womb? So what does rechem do for us? What does this notion of compassion do for us? Ultimately, it's the greatest ethical equalizer. For all created of one womb, it's very hard to lash out or to hate someone else. Okay, so that gets sort of to this question of, well, in practice, what does compassion mean in Judaism, right? So there's another kind of use of this word rechem in the book of Genesis, and it's the story of Joseph and his brothers. And if you know it, if you've seen Joseph in the Technicolor Dreamcoat, you know it. But this idea where, you know, Joseph gets sold off into slavery, and then years later he's reunited with his brothers. And when he sees his brothers for the first time after years, I mean, it's I think he's there for, you know, at least he was in prison for 13 years, so he's probably been in at least 2 decades in Egypt without seeing his brothers. And so Joseph basically in this passage says, And Joseph made haste, for his rechem yearned for his brothers, and he sought where to weep, so he went and found a place to cry, and he entered into his chambers, and he wept. So this notion of he saw his brothers, and his rechem, his womb, for lack of a better word, yearned for his brothers. So it's not just, it's important to know, it's not just a female imagery, right? It's this notion of like our soft place in our hearts is also our rechem, okay? So that's how we can get from, you know, sort of Job and being rechem being an equalizer, an ethical equalizer, to just literally the soft place in our hearts. Whether you're female or male, doesn't matter. You still have a rechem, I'm happy to tell you. So the other thing is we have this notion of God's compassion upon us. In the book of Isaiah, Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah says, "Can a woman forget her suckling child, that she should not have compassion on the son of her womb? Yes, even if they may forget, I will never forget you." So God says, yeah, well, you might forget that you bore this nation or this son, but God will never forget this notion of a maternal feeling towards the Israelites or towards you as human beings. And so it's also a notion of sort of protection. The rechem is a notion of to keep you safe. Exactly what a womb does is to keep you safe, to nurture you, to provide sustenance. And so that's what the prophet Isaiah is saying. You know, as humans, we may forget to have compassion. We may forget to open up our hearts, but God will never forget that. That's what Isaiah is saying. And sort of last but not least, this is very similarly in the book of Psalms. It says, as a father who pities his children, so does Adonai pity those who fear him. For God knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. As for man, his days are like grass. He flourishes like a flower of the field. For the wind passes over it, and it is gone, and its place knows it no more. But the loving kindness of Adonai, or the Lord, is from everlasting to everlasting upon those who worship him. So it's this notion that, you know, we can receive God's love and compassion, this notion that I talked about in the prophet Isaiah, as long as we continue to revere and be in awe of God and humility. So that's sort of the kind of promise in the book of Psalms. As long as we're continuing, you know, the word here is actually fear, but it's sort of a misnomer, because in Hebrew the word for fear is yirah, and yirah means literally both fear and awe. It doesn't have a negative valence in Hebrew. So when you read it in the English, you're like, fear, yes, you should fear God. But it's not necessarily true in Judaism. The idea of fear is bound up in the notion of awe and awesomeness, in the real sense of the word awesomeness. So that's what I wanted to start with in terms of the literally in one word, rechem, right? We have found maybe five different ways to understand compassion, right? And so that's number one in terms of sort of like what can Judaism tell us about the sort of expansiveness of this word compassion from a biblical Hebrew perspective. So what I want to do for the rest of the time that I have is that I want to sort of follow along with her chapter 7. And, you know, I sort of was fascinated by the sense of when I read it, basically I kept writing in the margins Jewish notions that was completely in line with what she was saying. So it was like, you know, as she was speaking, it was like she was speaking to me and I just had to translate it into Hebrew. You know, like, oh, that makes totally sense. That's this and that's that. So that's what I'm going to do with you guys, is sort of take you on a journey of, you know, if you were a rabbi, how would you read this chapter? So, you know, first she starts off with this notion of the science of compassion. And I think that what I liked about it was that in our daily lives, we often think about sort of compassion as a spiritual practice, right? How do we love people who are not us? How do we treat the other? How do we come, you know, to life in a place of openness and heart and warmth? But what Karen Armstrong, I think, is arguing here is that we can't just do that in personal practice. We have to do that in intellectual practice, too. That's what she calls the science of compassion. And she writes, you know, religious practice sounds strange to the modern ear, but we have to learn without our pre-modern suppositions. We have to leave that modernness behind, especially when you think about biblical Hebrew, like, oh, so archaic. But you have to leave that supposition behind. And she argues you have to make room for the other. So what does that mean, making room for the other? According to her, it's to remove our 20th century assumptions from our ancient spiritual practice. So basically what she's saying is we all are informed by the fact that we are living in a postmodern world with postmodern philosophies, whether we know it or not. But we have to sort of strip those away for a minute. And when we read the biblical text, we have to come to it not from a point of judgment, but of curiosity. And so I think that's what she's trying to teach with the science of compassion. I mean, I never had really heard that before, but it is what we teach when we do Torah study, is that you might not feel comfortable with everything in the Torah, but it's a historical document as much as it is a spiritual document. You have to really engage with it to understand it from the point of view of the people who wrote it 2,000 years ago, which I think is really hard for people to do because their morals are not our morals. Some of them are eternal, but some of them are grotesque. And what we talk about in Torah study a lot is that those hard moments is where we actually learn. Those points of confrontation where our morality rubs up against the morality of the Torah is a point of learning, not a point of pride. We're not proud that it happened, but we want to learn from it. And in the same way, it's like the imperfection of the stories, the imperfection of the Hebrew prophets, the imperfections of God in the Torah is a way for us to meet reality. Because if every story in the Torah was perfect, it'd be really hard to live up to it. Right? And what are we learning from it? Because we're imperfect. We are imperfect human beings. So how does it help us to read a perfect document with perfect role models? I mean, it's the beauty, I think, of Judaism and of Torah is that it meets sort of this sort of, there's an idealistic realism. It wants you to surpass the morality of the Torah by realizing to not make the same mistakes twice. So that's when we read Torah study, we read about it in light of, so, okay, how did they mess up? So let's not mess up this time. And we talk about it in terms of, you know, Joseph and his brothers. We talk about Cain and Abel. We can even talk about it, you know, in terms of our wanderings in the desert. All of these things are points of learning, not points of like, oh, well, that happened, so too bad. So that's sort of this idea that that I really liked about her is that, you know, she's asking us not to just show compassion in our daily life about, you know, helping somebody across the street or going to visit the sick, but really compassion in our intellectual curiosity, which I think is why you guys are here, I would guess, right? So the other thing I really liked about her, in chapter 7, she talked about the difference between science and religion. So she said, and science is inherently progressive. You know, you have a thesis and a hypothesis, and then you try to prove it, and then it's basically keeps on moving from there, right? Every new thesis turns into a new hypothesis, and it's inherently progressive. Versus what she argues, which I think is brilliant, is that religion is inherently non-progressive. We're asking the same questions as our ancient ancestors did. So this fundamental, you know, sort of existential questions of the world. What does it mean to be happy? What is truth? What is morality? What is justice? This notion that, you know, sort of we are asking the same questions as our ancient ancestors, whether they be Greek or Hindu or Muslim or Christian, it doesn't matter, but we're all inherently involved in a project of something that is so lifelong and eternal in the history of our universe. And I think that's such a profound notion that we're not necessarily trying to, you know, come up with a new hypothesis and a thesis and then, oh, we're done. We've solved the equation. But we are each generation, we're asking the same questions but with different perspectives. And it's kind of like a spiral rather than, you know, a straight linear line of, you know, we're coming from kind of ancient times of darkness to lightness. Like that's not sort of how I see it, and I think what she's saying is that we're always asking the questions anew in each generation, and they're just becoming more enlightened by the world we live in, by our own modern experience of the world. So what one of her quotes that I thought was beautiful, and I just bring that, and then I'm going to switch over to some rabbinic thinkers, is She says, science, medicine, and technology have improved the lives of millions, but unknowing remains an essential part of the human conditions, and religion is at its best when it helps us ask questions and holds us in a state of wonder. So as you know, the chapter of Title VII is How Little We Know. Right? So there's an assumption of both. It's the humility of knowledge. Right? And it goes back to the science of compassion, right? About intellectual compassion. And so she says, you know, that religion is at its best when it helps us to ask questions and holds us in a state of wonder. And I think that it is, like I said, it is so interesting that that's, you know, one of her main points in this chapter, because one of the greatest rabbinic thinkers of the 20th century, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, which some of you probably know his name, a great thinker, also a great person in the interfaith dialogue world, marched with Martin Luther King, and he writes that wonder rather than doubt is the root of all knowledge. Wonder rather than doubt is the root of all knowledge. So that goes back to this notion of awe and wonder. For Heschel, awe and wonder are two sort of sides of the same coin. That part of all of faith is wrapped up in awe and wonder. And one of my favorite quotes of a contemporary rabbi named Rabbi Erwin Kula, he says that if you have found an answer to your question, you probably aren't asking hard enough questions. And that's embedded in the Jewish tradition, is that we're not really looking for the answer, we're looking for the best questions. And that's why we're never really there. You know, we're never really reached the promised land. A student of mine asked, like, why doesn't Moses make it to the promised land? Because then we have an answer. We know what happened. But just like Moses doesn't reach the promised land, is this question, this notion of our questions are more important than our answers. And if we found an answer, it's not a good enough question. It's a continual yearning for knowledge in Judaism that doesn't end when we reach the promised land. So, you know, something that I often say in that same regard is that, you know, faith is no longer faith if the element of the unknown is taken away. Then it becomes certainty. Right? If we are certain of a certain belief, it is no longer faith. There has to be an element of doubt and wonder and awe. Because if we, like somebody asked the other day, if we are set in the way that we define God, it is no longer God. If we think we have an image of God in our mind, ultimately becomes idolatry, right? Because we've now put God enclosed God in a box. And God cannot be contained in a box. So a very famous feminist Jewish thinker, her name is Aviva Zornberg. Has anyone heard of her? Amazing biblical scholar. One of the premier females doing biblical scholarship in the world today. She lives in Jerusalem, but she's from Scotland, I believe. And she argues that sort of, what is the second commandment actually about? Right? So the first commandment, you know, I am Adonai, your God, and you should have no other gods beside me. So what is this notion of not having any other gods beside you? Well, if you start to create or fashion an idol, you're assuming that you know the parameters of God. And so the idea is that you can't have God with idolship, right? You can't have that because then you're assuming that you know what God is. And the commandment to not have idols is to not, again, put constraints on God. So that, it's not about, you know, it might have been about pagan, you know, worship, but it's much bigger than that. It's much bigger than that because today we obviously, you know, for all monotheistic faiths, we don't have idols. But we can create idols out of our own intellectual desire to say this is God and this isn't God. As soon as we said this is God and this is not God, we've decided we know what God is and we decided that's an idol. We'll worship that God. So when I talk to people about God in my congregation, you know, again, it's more about the questions than the answers. And we look at all the different notions of God in Judaism. And we continue to ask questions. So it's really, you know, again, this like notion that awe and wonder is the beginning of faith, not answer and certainty, not truth. So, you know, I like to say, you know, one of the things about this idea that if we remove the unknown from faith, it's no longer faith, it's certainty. As many of you have probably heard, Martin Luther King Jr. once said that faith is taking the first step even when you don't see the rest of the staircase. I love that image. Right? You have no idea what's about. Are you going up? Are you going down? Are you going to fall? Are you going to have a heart? You know, you have no idea what's next, but faith is taking the next step without knowing even where the staircase is. So that's, you know, from a modern point of view of Martin Luther King Jr. talks about this same notion of, you know, sort of having some kind of intellectual humility and bringing the unknown into our notion of faith rather than, you know, hubris of like, we know everything there is to know about scripture or God or religion. So to sort of like go back a little bit from Martin Luther King to, you know, the ancient rabbis, in the Mishnah, which is the commentary on the Torah, written around 200 BCE and compiled later on, but 1st-2nd century, the Ben Zoma, which is the name of the rabbi, said, "Who is wise? The one who learns from all people." So this notion is so deeply embedded in our ancient tradition. You know, we're having the title of how little we know. Well, you know, the rabbi said from very early on, the person who is wise is one who learns from all people. So the rabbis themselves, who sometimes had an inflated ego, you can tell by reading the scripture, they also said, if you're a true rabbi, you'll learn from your students as well. There's no such thing as a one-way learning. Learning has to be a dialectic, right? And if you fail to have that dialectic, then you're not really learning. So that's what that I wanted to bring in from our tradition, from the rabbinic tradition. So moving from sort of this idea of kind of the unknown and awe and wonder, I want to move to a different concept that she talks about. She says, and I think it's brilliant and sort of made my day because I was like, yeah, I need to think about that and I think bring it to my community, which is the question of why are we so certain about the world if nature is always changing, adapting, and growing? Human nature is to freeze our ideas and make them absolute, but the world around us is never frozen. It goes in direct contradistinction to nature. If we freeze our knowledge and we believe we have the answer, look around us. The world is always changing. The leaves are always moving. You know, trees are always growing. Grass is always growing. Everything about the world is dynamic, except many times for us and our beliefs and our kind of habits. Right? It's like so obvious, but it's so brilliant. You know, you just have to go out into nature, and when you're in Santa Barbara, it's the best thing. You know, you look outside, and you're like, where am I? I mean, this is really the closest thing you get to paradise that, you know, anywhere in the world, in my opinion. John Michael said that you guys are lucky to have me. I feel very blessed to be here, and I'm reminded every day of how beautiful nature is and how small we are. And this notion, you know, what I thought was that she says we cling to our certainties and saying they're essential to our own sense of self, and we alienate ourselves from the great transformation because the reality is that we are constantly in flux. Right? So we cling to our sense of self and our certitude and our beliefs, but the world outside is always in a great transformation. And it's, again, I'm blown away by the simplicity and how profound it is at the same time. Because really all you have to do after this is walk outside and look up and see, nothing that I know is true because everything's always changing. And so what was interesting to me about this notion of when I read the idea of great transformation is this notion of, in Hebrew we have called the Ruach Elohim. So often it's called, it's translated in Christian circles as the Spirit of God. And it's literally seen as a spirit. But in Judaism, Ruach is really the life breath. It's everything that makes us dynamic, right? It's God literally breathes into Adam's nostrils a ruach. So it can be seen as the animating life. It could be seen as the It can also be known as the wind. We pray for the wind and the rain in the winter. And it's just generally, not necessarily, it's not, I want to be kind of clear about this. It's not like we're hoping to be wrapped in the Spirit of God or the Spirit of God comes to us. It's called Ruach Elohim, but it actually means the animating life force that Armstrong is talking about. He's talking about this notion that everything is always in flux. Nature is always changing. And that is Ruach Elohim. And that's the notion that God animates, but that it might not, nature and God, the line is very fuzzy for me. Okay, we can talk about that later. Probably went down the rabbit hole there. So, if you ask me about God, I will say I do not know. I know a lot of things, but I don't know God. So we moved from sort of this idea of humility and awe and wonder to Ruach Elohim, the spirit that animates the entire world, to I'm labeling that Armstrong talks about is sort of self-abrogation. She talks about a story where a disciple of Confucius says, "I finally learned how to be as pious and as smart as you." And Confucius says, "How is that possible?" And the student says, "Sit quietly and forget." Do you remember that part of the chapter? Beautiful, right? Sit quietly and forget. And the first student's like, "I don't know what that means. You're crazy." And he says, the second student says, "When you sit quietly and forget, your body falls away and it lets your intellect fade. When you empty yourself of yourself, self-importance, selfishness, you begin to reflect others. So the selfishness and self-importance falls away and your ability to basically reflect others begins to come clear in the mirror." And she argues that, or Confucius, I would say, the scholar, Confucius's disciple, says that when you empty yourself is when you become able to have empathy. You know, so it's an interesting, there's a fine line here. I think that Confucius's sort of disciple says, the perfect man has no self. Right? So once he's realized that there's nothing special or particular about himself, then he regards all other people as I. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful notion. So once you realize there's nothing innately unique about, and it goes back to this concept of womb. If we're all created from the same womb, right, from the same rechem, then what's unique about me? Yeah, I have my own look, I have my own thoughts, I have my own breath, but ultimately it's this notion that we're all connected to something far greater. And so, basically, you know, the disciple of Confucius is saying, the perfect man has no self. So, it's in essence, I agree with it. And then there's like 5% of me that says, there's something very, you know, sort of not Jewish about this statement. Okay, because in Judaism, we never really negate ourselves. We're never nothing. It's really important. I think, and I know, if there is somebody who really understands Buddhism or practices Buddhism, my understanding is there is a lot of negation of self in Buddhism. I don't want to speak, you know, I'm certainly coming this from a level of humility because I studied Buddhism as a freshman in college. So my notion of Buddhism is very stale, I would say. But this notion of, like, there is some traditions or this set, even aesthetic monks, you know, who really are about the negation of self to get to a higher spiritual realm. Judaism doesn't really teach us that. It really has us, we're really embodied. You know, we praise God through, you know, every time we have a piece of food, we bless it. Right? We're not about negating ourselves. We know we're embodied. We don't negate ourselves. But, just to complicate matters, there is this notion in the mystical tradition of Judaism called Bitul Yesh, which is really too complicated to really fully explain. And for me to understand exactly, but the notion of Bitul Yesh is this notion of, there's not a good English translation for it, but it's kind of like diminishing or cancellation, but it's not exactly. Sort of the, I had a word for it when I came this morning. this is a problem with Hebrew. It's sort of like the diminishing or the cancellation of oneself. That's the negation of oneself. But not negation in the sense of absence. That's really important. The negation is this idea of what we call in Hebrew tzimtzum, which is contraction. So can we contract ourselves to be small enough to make room for the other? Right? Which is how she starts her chapter. Can you make room for the other? And so that's the notion of bitul yesh. And it is a Jewish concept. It's not that, you know, it's not all over the place. It's very much in the mystical tradition, but, you know, which doesn't come to us until the 12th century. So it really isn't, you know, it's a historical progression that's a little bit later. But there is this notion, very similarly to what Confucius is speaking about in this, or Karen Armstrong is teaching about with Confucius, there is a parallel teaching in Judaism of this notion of contraction. And sort of the idea that in order to, you know, particularly what she says is that once you realize that you're not 100% unique, then you can meet the other. There's a Jewish philosopher named Immanuel Levinas, I think 20th century or 19th century, and he really talks about sort of the encounter with the other. You know, sort of the entire ethical basis of Judaism, he argues, is that when you're able to see somebody face to face, then you can encounter the other. Right? That is the primary thing in Judaism, is that you have to know the other or you can't know God. Right? If you can't know the other, you cannot know God. If you cannot make room for the other, you cannot know God. Because God is the ultimate other. Okay? So, I will say, I pretty much have one last thing to say and then I'm going to turn it over for break. I don't know how we're doing on time. We're good. So, okay, so I'm going to just give one last quote from Abraham Joshua Heschel. And Heschel says, God is not a hypothesis derived from logical assumptions, but an immediate insight, self-evident as light. God is not something to be sought in the darkness with the light of reason. God is the light. So God is not something to be sought in the darkness with the light of reason, not to rationalize, but God is the light. So this is, again, this is a 20th century Jewish thinker who, you know, sort of takes this notion of everything we can do in sort of the post-industrial era of understanding religion vis-a-vis science. He's arguing you can't do that. You cannot use the light of reason to find God because God is the light. And I just want to leave us with that thought and then we can come back later, I guess.